Ross Oswald is a partner and co-founder of Hall & Oswald, a food broker based out of Kent, Washington. He joins me today to talk about commodity markets, the economics of the food supply chain, what a food broker does, and what questions your restaurant should be asking a distributor to become a better buyer on commodities like dairy, proteins, produce, and much more. If you stick around to the last 30 minutes of this episode, Ross and I jumped into a really interesting conversation about the broader markets as a whole. We touched on the correlation between commodities, inflation versus deflation, and the price of debt. We even talk a little bit about monetary policy, the Federal Reserve, and one of my favorite commodities, gold. It was a privilege talking to Ross today. He's someone who has clearly spent a lot of time thinking about and researching the topics we discussed, such as the commodities, markets, and then economics as it relates to food in general. All right, without further ado, here's my interview with Ross. Enjoy. Ross, how you doing?
I'm great today. Thanks for having me on, David.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for being able to do this such short notice. We just chatted earlier this week and touched on some really cool topics, touched on dairy and cheese, commodities, economics as a whole. I got really excited about the conversation and said, hey, let's jump on and record this thing. And I think a lot of this content will be super valuable to my listeners. And if you want to start here, who's Hall & Oswald? What is Hall & Oswald? What do you guys do?
So we're food brokers, and nobody really understands that. I think my entire career, you know, you're at a cocktail party or someplace, you have to explain what it actually is. So we're really sales agents for companies that don't have a direct sales force. And then we cover the Northwest. So we cover Oregon, Washington, Alaska, and part of Idaho, and to the food service trade. So that's all away from home dining. And so bulk products to restaurants. And then kind of how that works is, so a manufacturer, like I'll use one for example, is Sorrento Cheese, which is owned by Lactalis out of France. Mm-hmm. They hire us to prospect for them and develop their brand and customer base for distributors to deliver products to. So we don't have trucks and we don't take ownership of the product. We get a commission based on sales in the market. So we're managing, you know, kind of the supply chain as far as getting it to people and, you know, watching freight, but generally it's calling on, you know, high volume places. So, you know, Costco's in our territory, Papa Murphy's, but then also just the single unit Joey's Pizza is in our market. So we call on those, demonstrate products, and then organize distribution to them, and then also typically manage pricing through that process. And then over the years, we've had a brokerage business since 89, and did a lot of seafood initially, Microsoft and a bunch of techs up here, and they were spending like crazy people up through 99. Mm-hmm. After that, the tech crash, we kind of readjusted into pizza and Italian, and that's been really strong for us for the last 20 years, because it's you know, pizza used to be a specialty food. Now it's just kind of like, you know, probably people eat more pizza than hamburgers almost. So that's kind of what we do, and we've done it, you know, for quite a while. And I've, you know, represented cheese companies all that time, and probably most of the major brands in the market. So I don't, does that answer that?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. I actually wasn't aware. So you and I met through one of my customers, actually through a mutual customer who is a smaller four unit pizza chain. So that makes a lot of sense. I didn't realize that you also had Costco and some bigger retail businesses. Are you guys primarily selling bulk product into big retailers like that, or
It's usually like, so we're in grocery too. So like a Costco, I've had products in there off and on, but you know, any of the big ones, you get them and it's a home run, but then you home runs are few and far between. So you kind of live on singles and walks, using a baseball analogy. Sure. So, you know, you're the customer we share, you know, actually is a good customer. That's a four unit guy. That'd be a double for me. But it's bulk. So like, you know, the grocery business, not so much in, you know, groceries kind of turned into Kroger, Safeway, Target. Well, those buying offices are outside of our market, but there are still independents that are, you know, but there's quite a few 8 and 10 unit guys. So their service deli area, they're still making food in there. And so, and that's like a restaurant in the service deli area. So we call in those and have product in there. Any place we can push it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that. I know that for sure. Especially this time in the cycle when, you know, people are changing distributors, customers are looking around, we're grabbing new customers. People are needing brokers, needing to lean on brokers to find those good partnerships. I looked a little bit into...
You touched on a really interesting thing is the manufacturers typically are committed to, you know, one segment or the other, retail or food service, because of the pack sizes. Well, because of what's gone on with COVID, we have food service guys trying to figure out how to get into retail. And one of them, I've got a super good olive oil, California fall harvest olive oil that's just awesome. We have Ethan Stoll and Tom Douglas, chefs using that product, but their business is closed. So we're looking for retail. But the problem is we're going in there with a package that's on the would be on the shelf for $75. Not very many people will pick up an olive oil, even if it's a good value, for $75, because the pack sizes, people are used to picking up 500 milliliters and, you know, paying $12, you know. So, it's an interesting time, people looking for, you know, because people still eat, but they're eating more at the grocery store than they are in a restaurant nowadays.
Yep. I think that's something that people don't really, or consumers don't really think about and realize is when we did have this shortage at the beginning of the year, in places like Costco with things like toilet paper and things that are maybe manufactured specifically for those retailers. You look around and you see Georgia-Pacific and all these other manufacturers producing a ton of product, but it's for, it's the larger rolls of toilet paper that are being produced for office buildings and restaurants and things like that. So It takes a minute for big manufacturers or food producers, anybody in this industry, to switch gears and switch the thing that they're producing. They can't just flip a light switch and start producing smaller TP containers or smaller blocks of cheese or smaller containers of olive oil.
Toilet paper was kind of an interesting one, though, that I don't quite understand, because the consumption of toilet paper really shouldn't change a lot.
Well, yeah, I was thinking a lot about that, trying to understand why there was a shortage. And what I landed on is that it was likely, you have a single use one roll, comes in a 30 pack of rolls, and those are for your household or even for a smaller restaurant. But then you have the industrial size, and they're the big ones. And they're the ones that you can't go to Costco and purchase, or you can't go to, you know, Safeway and purchase those for your home. So when we saw that shortage, there's still a lot of toilet paper being produced, but they're the larger rolls that need a whole separate dispenser. You know what I mean? One of those.
Right.
Yeah. So that's kind of where I landed on it. And I know that it takes a long time to, because there's two different machines entirely, just like paper bags or anything in paper and plastic production takes a whole different machine or different parts. You have to swap out parts on a machine to make different sizes. So not just the pack size, but the actual physical size. Yeah. So, okay. That's a great segue actually into, I wanted to talk specifically today after our conversation the other day, I wanted to talk about cheese. We talked a little bit about dairy. We talked a little bit about cheese. A lot of your business has ventured into, and you guys have done a really excellent job getting into the pizza space. So obviously cheese is one of the, it's probably top of your mind. So as a commodity, the cheese pricing, what's going on right now with the price of cheese? I saw it was going up. I don't know if we have some relief coming up. Sounds like we might. Would you be able to just talk through that a little bit?
Sure. So it kind of we'll cover two different things. One is just the change that occurred, for two reasons. One, just the cyclical nature of the dairy market. throughout the year, and then also what COVID did, but then also the price components of it is kind of a separate topic. So what's been, or I guess the calendar, what happens in dairy is, you know, there's kind of a fixed number of cows out there. They milk them twice a day. So every cow gives kind of out the same amount of output. So it doesn't change a lot. Like, I think dairy output is supposed to increase 1.6% this year. So it's not, it's kind of a set amount of milk is coming out. And so you would think that's real stable pricing. But what happens is they got to move the price up and down to get retailers to put it on ad to push more of it. And actual consumption of milk, if you think about yourself, probably you don't drink as much fluid milk as you did as a child, or, you know, years ago, there was just more milk being consumed. And people, yeah. Now there's a lot of beverage alternatives. So you see in the grocery store, kind of what's been going on is you see more, you know, yogurt, butter choices, cheese choices, because they still got to get rid of that milk. And so, but what happens during the year is the same amount of milk's coming out pretty much all the time. Summer heat stresses cows a little bit, and there's a little less milk, but also vacations really, in hot weather, spike ice cream sales. So it's a big demand on.
Okay.
And so the prices go up in the summer. And then they'll kind of hold up, because once school goes back in, I think there's like, you know, probably 30, 40 million school-age kids that go to school and get a half pint of milk for lunch. So that's, you know, a big chunk of demand on those cows. And then when school closes down in December and colder weather, December, January is low. So there's always throughout the year, some movement in the price of cheese, but typically it's maybe 40 cents a pound from low to high, 50 cents some years, but that's kind of the number. What happened this year is middle of March, all of a sudden the restaurants stopped. Cheese prices dropped about 80 cents a pound, way below the cost of production for the dairy farmers. And kind of a segue there, dairy is all contracted, because those cows give milk every single day. It's every day or 2 days going to the, either being bottled or cartoned as fluid milk, or the cheese factories produced into block cheeses. What's happened is it stopped, the pricing dumped, but then everybody readjusted and figured out, grocery stores were, sales were going up, so they shifted into smaller packages. Well, then what happened was you go to a restaurant, you didn't usually order, you know, quesadilla or a cheese sandwich. You go to the restaurant, you have, you know, halibut and salmon and, you know, items that you can't cook at home. Well, you start, restaurants close, you eat at home, all of a sudden people started buying a lot more cheese because it's easy to cook.
Very true.
Yeah. So the cheese plant that I represent, their sales at retail were like at 125%. Well, no plant has excess capacity much, so they're just totally maxed out on it. Well, then on the restaurant side, people don't like to cook at home, so they look at what they still can buy, and they're buying a lot of pizza. So both food service and retail drove cheese sales up. In Seattle, they're trying to sell, like, there's a boat at the Fisherman's Wharf. They're selling tuna right off the boat because they don't have a market for it. The restaurants are closed. So, you know, seafood prices dropped a lot, but cheese prices went up a lot. So from the 80 cent drop in just 6 weeks, it went up $2. So $1.20 above what kind of was historical pricing.
Okay. Ross, for anybody that's not in the pizza business or the cheese business, when you see an 80% drop or a $2 increase, what is that roughly percentage wise? I mean, when you say per pound, is cheese $2 per pound to begin with, $3 per pound?
So we can, I was going to kind of segue into that way cheese really is priced, and that's probably, we'll go to that now. So the dairy farmer, There's a lot of data, but dairy farmer, they're priced, the way they sell milk is for 100 pounds of milk. 100 pounds, it's 8 pounds a gallon. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, 12 gallons of milk is what they sell per year.
That's 100. That's the commodity price of,
yeah, 100, milk. Yeah, 100 pounds. And if you, a great site to look up on is cheesereporter.com. They have a pull down. It has pricing on, you know, butter, milk, non-fat milk, and historical. You can look at 3 years of past pricing. But so the dairy farmers getting their cost, so feed and overhead, is about $14 per hundredweight. So times are bad, they're getting $12, getting below their production cost. That's why dairies are shrinking out there or consolidating. And then when it's good, they'll be, you know, up at just above that $14. So it takes 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese, about. So if milk is, you know, $14 a hundredweight for 100 pounds, that's about $1.40 per pound cost to make cheese. So, that's traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and there's daily trades. It's not a big market, but that's the number I was talking about. So it had been about $1.80, and that price is if you bought on the exchange a truckload or a rail car of cheese, and it's usually somebody like Schreiber selling it to Kraft, you know, big sales like that, you'd pay that FOB Chicago price. So it was $1.80. It dropped to $1, which is, you know, way below everybody's production cost, but then quickly climbed to $3. Since then, everybody's kind of adjusted.
Wow.
The dairies are a little less affected by COVID for labor because they're automated. So it's not like the meat processing plants where there's a lot of labor doing handwork. They're still affected, but not to the same extent. So pricing was at $3. And then in the last really 3 weeks, and this week the most, it's dropped back down to the $1.80. So it's almost washed completely through the system, the price swing. So, which is great news for the pizzerias or any cheese consumer. Because yeah, this is kind of how the pricing works from that Wisconsin block market or the CME market. So if it's $1, when the market was $1.80, the manufacturers may sell to ABC Distributing for about 40 cents over that block market. So if it's $1.80, they'd sell FOB their plant for $2.20. Then it usually costs like 10 to 15 cents to move it to the location. So, you know, landed on the West Coast, then you got product that's, you know, $2.35 a pound. So 180, you know, 40 over the block, 15 cents freight. The distributor has, you know, that price into it. And then they may mark it up, you know, super aggressive might be 20 cents a pound, you know, a little better margin might be 30 cents a pound. So that's out at that, you know, the price of, you know, to say we're at 250 a pound. Well, that 250 price had, you know, dropped to 80 cents and then swung back up, you know, $2. Mm-hmm. So big hurt on the pizzerias because there's maybe close to a pound, a large pizza from, you know, good toppings on it might be a pound of cheese. So if the price of cheese went up $1, their pizza really had to go up $3. And they really can't pass on, or they don't feel like they can pass on that price increase. So
yeah.
That's kind of, I don't know, that made sense about how, where the raw commodity starts and what it ends up at in the restaurant.
Absolutely. That was a really good rundown. I learned a few things there.
Yeah.
One thing that,
and then one other piece that's kind of interesting. So grocery stores, they don't like the consumer to know it, but they generally work on 50% margin, or which is 100% markup. And that's probably the one thing to learn today is the difference between margin and markup. And I know, David, you know it well because it's in every distributor's playbook.
Jump into it. A lot of people don't know the difference.
Yeah. So if you pay $75 for something and then you sell it for $100, you've marked it up $25 or a third. So that's a third markup, 33%. But if you sell it for $100 and $25 of it was profit, that's a 25% margin. So it's easy to do with that 75 and 100 number, but there's a big difference because one's 25% margin, one 33% markup, but in both cases, it's profit of $25. So the grocery stores, though, make 50% margin or 100% markup. So when cheese went up, you know, $1, $1.20 a pound, it hits the consumer going up $2.50 a pound. Well, then people walk by cheese and think, I'm not buying that. I can buy pasta or tomato sauce. So, and that's actually probably what caused this price drop is dairy got expensive. And in retail, this is kind of the economic side, there's good substitutions. Because you're in the grocery store and you're thinking, oh, I want to make, that's too expensive. I'll walk by it and buy pasta, tomato, spaghetti sauce. And I just didn't buy the cheese. Well, when you're a pizzeria, you can't substitute. You got to use that product. And that's really what inelastic demand is that it doesn't matter the price, they got to buy it. So fortunately, retail, you know, it's really elastic demand where people substitute. And that's what's brought that dairy market back down is retail sales are softening. Food service kind of stays stable. And the price kind of finds a level where all the milk moves. Any questions about that?
Okay. No. I'm glad that you jumped into that with the elastic and inelastic, the difference between what those two components are. Because yeah, you're absolutely right. That's not something that that our shared customer or that any other customers that we might have from a restaurant level, they can't just switch that. So when we see an 80% bump or a 100% bump in the price of cheese, they have to absorb that, especially with, and my viewers and you know, I work with chain restaurants, I work with large national accounts, and they're not going to change the pricing. So they actually have to take that hit. They have some of those things factored into the pricing across the board anyways, a buffer for the flux of the pricing and things like commodities, you know, produce and dairy especially. But they, if it was sustained any longer, those conversations would have to start happening at the leadership level or the corporate level of these restaurants and restaurant chains that they might need to start increasing price. So it's good that we see some relief on the horizon because everyone, and I'm so glad that you went through the whole process of the farmer and manufacturer, you know, the dairy farmer manufacturer, the processor, the distributor, and then to the restaurant, and then the restaurant has to mark it up too, because every single component, and I've talked about this a lot, every single component through this chain, you know, has people and has labor and has the overhead and all of these expenses that a lot of people don't really think about. They think, all right, yeah, so it's $1, maybe add 5 cents. That sounds good. Put it on a truck. Maybe that's another 5 cents, but it gets expensive and you have to go through and we'll get here later in the conversation, but you really have to go through and tack on, you know, what is the price of gas, of diesel fuel, of other commodities? So all of these, the entire supply chain and from the beginning of, you know, you have a cow in a field to the end of it where you have, you know, cheese on a taco is there are so many components to it and it's all completely connected and it all has to do with what the overarching markets are doing. And so it's thanks for jumping into that. Thanks for touching base on all those.
And there's one more area that you can probably do a whole segment on, but it's a good resource for your listeners is the USDA site. It's ams.usda.gov. So it's the Agricultural Marketing Service USDA.gov. And there is just a library. It's like walking into a library of information in there. But on that one, it goes through what specific to cheese, what the USDA is doing to supply really the food banks and nonprofits nationally And so like this morning I looked at, I was going to, if my video was working, I was going to show you, but there was $17 million worth of non-fat powders, 8 million pounds of shredded mozzarella. And that's a 1 week distribution. Oh, I think it was another, it was like $39 million of aseptic milk that goes to distribution points throughout the country to really supply food banks for people that, you know, are in need of food for, you know, they don't have food safety and are relying on food banks for their nutrition. So what happened is the USDA on short notice, when all these unemployment hit, started a new program. It was the Farm to Consumer Box Program. And they start, I had a call from a dairy distributor locally that wanted just new business, 40,000 pounds a week of 1 pound cheddar to distribute. Well, just this area, if you extrapolate, that's like 2 million pounds a week of new business of 1 pound cheddar nationally. Hard to find it. They ended up finding it from a company out of Texas to ship it to Washington to distribute to food banks here.
Oh, man.
But when all of a sudden you just nail 2 million pounds of cheese, new customer, it also pushes dairy pricing. So the government was taking care of people in need, taking care of dairy farmers that for a short amount of time were dumping milk, but it also pushed pricing. And that program's continuing on. They're awarding it in 60-day cycles, but they have 2 years worth of funding.
Okay.
$6 billion dollars.
Wow. So that, yeah, I mean, those are not small numbers. That can absolutely make a dent in the pricing.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So I think, I mean, unless you had anything else to touch on with cheese pricing or all those factors, I mean, we kind of went all over the map there, and I'm really glad that we did, because that was a good overall look at, you know, beginning to end on something like cheese. We haven't even gotten into any other commodities or any other, you know, components aside from dairy, and we'll probably save that. I mean, I'd love to have you back on again to talk about other commodities too, so we'll definitely go through the USDA.
Probably the last thing, and you've kind of covered this I think on some of your other segments, but specific to just where the product sits, just so people understand if there's a disruption, it's catastrophic quickly, is dairy farms don't hold milk. You know, they may be 1 day, 2 days, because they got to refrigerate it, and it goes to a manufacturer. The manufacturer, they're making product, but they may have 3 days worth of product. Maybe they hold aged cheese for a week, you know, so, but they may at most 7 days. When it hits a distributor, distributors are like, your company, typically their buyers are told to turn inventory weekly and maybe a few days of safety stock. Your customers don't like to hear it, but that's the reality of because it costs a lot of money to have a big warehouse. So, you know, maybe a week's worth of product at the distributor. And then at least at the restaurant business that I see, they're getting 2 and 3 day a week delivery, and they're not carrying extra inventory. So they have, you know, a couple of days, 3 days worth of inventory on their key items. So the whole, you know, in that whole, maybe 3 weeks. So if there's disruption, you know, there's 3 weeks of product in the supply chain, and then it's gone. So, and then the only way to handle it is raise pricing to slow down the sales or just short, you know, and historically we saw price increases, but now it's so disrupted in other commodities that it's just shortages. It doesn't matter the price, you can't get it.
Yep.
And it's probably COVID related issues or the federal unemployment that's discouraged labor.
Yeah. So you've already touched on food banks. You've already touched on kind of what some of the demand is, at least up here in the Northwest. That's a perfect segue into impacts that COVID-19 has had. And we already kind of talked about it a little bit, but what are the main things that you're seeing that are different in, and we'll just take dairy again specifically, or cheese specifically, instead of a normal market cycle this time of year, what are the main points that are different because of COVID?
People are eating a ton of pizza. So there may be, I think I'd invest in, let's say, Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, because people are eating a lot of pizza.
Yeah, looking ahead to the fall. Yeah, the Peloton and all that stuff.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, so that probably the consumption is probably the big thing, not at the dairy plants, but the other commodities that we deal with or other ingredients. Labor, you know, is definitely an issue. The restaurant side of it, I don't know if you've touched on that, but people are, you know, they came out with I have a friend that owns a restaurant. He got $150,000 in PPP. He got a $450,000 disaster loan. So he's got $600,000 is sitting in the bank. The restaurant's still closed. He can't do anything with the $600,000. He's living in a trailer in Eastern Washington, just hiking, waiting to find out if his restaurant can reopen, not paying a lease. And that's probably what's going on everywhere is your restaurants can't pay their rent or their lease, aren't open unless their, you know, their food lends itself to, you know, take out a delivery. So it's really rough on that segment and don't see any solution to that short of a vaccine right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's unfortunate. We have a lot of customer groups in one of our new Kent warehouses that are going through the same, I shouldn't say groups, actually, a lot of one-off customers, one-off restaurants that are going through something similar, where they are relying 100% on dine-in, and they've had to close down. They can, and they have throughout this whole process, have been able to open at 50%. If they put all of the, you know, have somebody sanitizing tabletops and wearing the protective equipment and all of that. So really it's, I've been seeing a squeeze on this middle of the road restaurant where it's, you know, like your friend that you're describing. They don't have multiple units. They don't have drive-throughs. They don't have a takeout situation set up already. They're not doing DoorDash or any of that stuff. Or at least they weren't set up prior to, and they, you know, were a happening place before all of this where people could come and get food inside. Everything is so up in the air that nobody's trying to risk changing their entire business model around something that could be gone and back to normal in a month, highly unlikely as we've talked about, or it could extend into 2021, or it could extend until, to your point, until we get a vaccine or something like that, where people feel confident to open their businesses. So that story is not uncommon. I have a few customers or a few, you know, temporarily old customers that have closed the doors that are going through the same thing where they have capital, which is good. They have some funds that they're sitting on and they're waiting, but right now it's just a waiting game, and it's a huge challenge.
Right. Yeah. So, and you may have covered this also before, but for your listeners, you know, the restaurant business, generally their costs are, kind of in 3/3. Their food cost is about 1/3. They run really nice, food costs, like pizzas, less expensive. They get down to 25, but you know, seafood place might be 35%, but 1/3 in food, 1/3 in labor, and 1/3 in fixed overhead and profit. So, and profit usually, you know, if you run a really, you know, well run, you might get 10% profit, but you know, that can disappear pretty quickly. But what people, a lot of times my, you know, neighbors I talk to don't get is, you know, that fixed cost, you know, a rent on a place that's, you know, 3,000 square feet might be, you know, $30 a square foot annually. So it's, you know, they may be paying $8,000 a month. Well, you're getting that back $20 a pizza at a time, or $25 a pizza at a time. And you got to cover $8,000. So you do have to have a certain amount of volume. And then they rely on, you know, liquor sales, really, or alcohol sales that, you know, raise the guest check. And so when you just do takeout, you're kind of not, you don't have that revenue there on the alcohol sales and the bar sales to kind of cover that, you know, because you don't, for delivery, you don't need, you know, sit-down dining. So the sit-down dining places need bar sales. And when you, the bars aren't open, they're not at 25 or 50% because of social distancing issues. So you don't have that revenue.
That is such a good point. No, I haven't covered that anywhere. That is absolutely key to understand here why a lot of these operators that depend on dine-in customers are having such a hard time. A lot of people think, hey, just sign up for DoorDash. Not to mention that, you know, they have ridiculous markups for their service.
Right.
The alcohol sales, you know, and a lot of these restaurants, just not to go too far down this, but they have something that's, you know, referred to as a loss leader, where they'll attract people in for something that's inexpensive, but very low margin for the operator, for the restaurant. And they depend on the sale of alcohol and, you know, sides and other things to tack on to, and that's what they train their servers to do, is, you know, upsell and add items onto the bill to get those higher margin items. So that's it completely blows out the business model of a lot of these independent restaurants when you start to see things like 50% capacity caps on the in the dining room and some of the other stuff that we've talked about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I mean that's a great way to jump into the next thing I wanted to talk about. As an operator, as a restaurant owner, or a manager that orders the food, anybody listening to this, what should they be asking their distributor or asking their broker? How do they, how can they be better buyers on something like cheese or dairy or commodities as a whole?
So, because I spend a lot of my time with individual restaurateurs and, you know, have the history with distributors and manufacturers, you know, what I see is probably the worst mistake. There's two ends of the spectrum. There's the guys that price everybody out and use 3 and 4 distributors and always trying to get the best deal. And they're spending too much time in the back of the house just on price and not building sales in the front of the house. But then I also see the other end of the spectrum where they don't police the distributor at all. So what I tell people to do is go to, you know, one of the cash and carry operations, like, you know, Costco Business Center, Restaurant Depot on the West Coast, there's Smart and Final, and just price out a number of your items. You're not going to get everybody to match them, but at least you're now knowledgeable about what somebody that works, buys right and works on small margins sells it for. So at least you have an idea what the range is. Because what I see, I'll look at invoices and yeah, the customer's getting a great price on cheese, but then it's like, wow, paper towels are supposed to be 20 and they're paying 80.
Yep.
You know, because the distributor, if you buy from multiple distributors, so they're not making very much money on the stop, they got to get it somehow, because it costs money to stop that truck. You know, it might be a union driver, you know, it's an expensive truck, a big warehouse, just all those costs, and they got to get it, and they're going to get it somewhere. So the best thing is to work with a distributor partner and find somebody that has the most of the items you want and will treat you fairly. And a lot of times that's your rep. But if you get one you like that'll work for you, is knowledgeable, and then is they'll consider what your research you've done, knowing that they can't sell it at that price because they're giving more service. That's the best thing that somebody can do, instead of, you know, calling up, you know, or having the guys come in the back door and asking 5 guys what's their price on mozzarella. And then next week it changes. It's just way better for you to be informed and then partner with somebody. Probably the other thing is on each ingredient that's a key ingredient is have a substitute available. So like if, you know, my go-to cheese is Sorrento that I represent, but I know I've tested Saputo's product and that's acceptable. So that if Serrano something happens, I already have it lined up on what to go to.
Yep.
Or I also can compare pricing then on that. The other thing that people need to do is distributors to enhance or stabilize their margins, push private label, and just be aware of who the packers are on those. Find out who the packers are on those private labels. Most protein items have a USDA bug on it, Google the bug, you can see that, oh, it says, you know, Cisco or ABC distributor, but it's made by Tyson or it's made by Hormel. So then you can go to your other distributor and say, well, Hormel has this item. I buy it under this distributor label, but do you have it? Because then you at least can shop it and you understand, you know, who the packer is behind that product. Can't do it on every item. It's too much, you know, too much detail, but on your key items, get your top 10 and get them right.
Yep, that's great advice. I always tell people, so first on both of those points, first, know your numbers, know inside, know what your profit margin is, know what everything is costed down to the portion of each item in each dish that you're selling. That's absolutely key. And outside of that, you really need to know the numbers of the commodity pricing of the products that you are purchasing. And sometimes it takes, you know, if you're listening to this, you don't have a lot of time to do all this stuff. So sometimes you will put your trust in a broker or a distributor or a couple of distributors or something like that, or just your account rep. But it, the more you know, the less likely you are to either get, I don't want to say anybody would take advantage, but the more you know, the less likely that is to happen. You really need to have an understanding, not just of how the your business is working internally, but what the external forces on the pricing and your business are. It's so key. So it's, you know your numbers, understand your numbers, treat your restaurant like it's an investment, because it is, right? It's you gotta know where all the bones are buried.
Yeah, probably one more thing for, a lot of restaurateurs, I think, understand this. But as a consumer, if I go into Safeway, everybody pays the same price for a bottle of Heinz ketchup. It's on the shelf, the price is on it. In the restaurant business, nobody pays the same price for a case of. It's all variable, it completely in control of the account rep. With chain accounts, they may have a contract. So, but that contracts are different for every chain account. And then, additionally, the sales rep even has a different cost that he's marking it up from. So chain accounts have a different cost basis at the distributor than a street account person does, we could go into the details of that, but that's kind of mind bending for operators to think, no, wait, I get that we have a different cost than the restaurant across the street, but the sales rep has a different cost for me than the guy across the street. That doesn't make sense to them. And that's the reality of the deviated pricing concept with distribution.
Yep. And rep controlled pricing. And that's something I talk about a lot. I've worked for different distributors. Some of them have it, some of them don't. There's no right or wrong. You really just need to understand what goes into the components. And you can ask, ask us sales guys, we'll be very transparent about what the process is, because it's all out in the open. If you ask the questions or if you look it up, the way that rep controlled pricing works, or just fixed, fee per case pricing with larger accounts or chain accounts, national accounts, stuff like that. It's absolutely ask questions. That's the main thing that I always try to get across too. Know your numbers and ask questions. And if you're working with anybody in this industry that, keeps their cards close and doesn't want to reveal, what commodity pricing is, and, cause all you need to know, what's your cost and what's the commodity cost, and you can get an idea of what that markup is in between. Right. So if anybody's not sharing that information, that should absolutely be a red flag, because that should be out in the open. And that's how, we're in the business of relationships, not just moving boxes and selling food. So if you really want to be able to have those open conversations, and you'd be surprised how little there really is in, in these margins or in these products for everybody who touches them. That's kind of what, we all knew that getting into the food business. Maybe some of us more than others or less than others, but we're all doing
it. A lot of, there's a couple ethnic groups that want to buy direct, and are kind of known for, I don't want that to be perceived as a racist comment, but your customers, your listeners will know them. So they'll want to buy direct. And I'll say, sure. Okay, so it's a 40-foot truck, it's 1,000 cases of canned goods, and you'll save $2 a case. What? I thought I'd get it for, half price. No, the distributor's making $2 a case on that. So you gotta buy a warehouse, you have to have a forklift, you know, so the margins aren't that high. You know, it's enough, you know, to make a living at it and pay all the bills, but it's not, you know, high tech margins.
Yep. You're spot on. Yeah. So one thing that you did touch on that I wanted to go back to real quick, when you're talking about have all of your items, all your key items, make sure you cost them off and pay attention to what's going on in the markets outside of, you know, in commodities for your key items. It's good to have a backup, but you don't know if that backup is going to be good or not, if it's going to cut the same. So what I have recommended with customers and what we've done on multiple occasions, I mean, like countless occasions, is you order in 5 or 6, up to 10 substitute items of key items, order them into your restaurant, do it on a Thursday afternoon or a Wednesday afternoon, sometime when you're not as busy, bring your rep in, bring the chef in and have a cutting, actually make the dish with the substitute item and make sure that this is something just in case we get into a shortage, a supply crunch or something that's not foreseen, that you have this and you've tested it, you've tasted it. Maybe you just need to add some seasoning to it, or maybe you need to cook it a different way and it cuts the same. So it's good to get that. I mean, it would have been better to do it last year because now we're in a situation where we actually have these supply crunches and we're having to deal with substitutions. But maybe now's the time to do it in case something like this happens again and you can't get your Tyson chicken or you can't get, you know, it's hard to do tomato sauces because people, especially in your business, you know, they've fallen in love with Stanislaus and that's all they'll ever use. I don't think there's any supply issues there. So don't take that the wrong way.
No.
Yeah.
That's the nice thing about, you know, canned goods or items that are, you know, have a, you know, they have a season and a harvest and then they're packed for the year and they pack maybe 15 months worth to carry over, you know, so there's no disruption at all, you know, on canned goods. If they're imported, that's a, you know, sometimes there's some transportation issues, but generally, you know, canned goods are no problem. It's the, you know, the fresh commodities, and as consumers and in restaurants, we want, you know, blueberries year round. Well, you can't grow blueberries in Seattle year round. You can get them part of the year, but not year round. So now you're relying on transportation and freight and, you know, trade and borders and exchange rates and, you know, all those issues. And so it makes it more complicated, definitely.
Okay. So, I mean, another one of the reasons why I really wanted to chat with you, and I thought that your knowledge would be great for my listeners and for other people to learn from, is just you have a vast understanding of, obviously, of economics and of commodities. Would you be able to share, you already shared USDA, what are some other resources that you use, either podcasts or newsletters, websites like the USDA.gov, books, anything that would be helpful for people who want to try and understand these markets the way that you do?
You know, that's interesting. I really don't know. I've been at it a while, but I probably gather the most just being in a lot of restaurants. So I see, you know, that's how I see what distributors are doing, what other packers are doing, you know, how things are priced, what's available. Trade shows is probably a good one. So if you go to the, you know, NRA in Chicago, everything was canceled this year because of COVID, but you'll see all the manufacturers there with their, you know, new products. In my category, there's the Pizza Expo in Las Vegas. And so
did you go last year?
They canceled it, and I went 2019, but 2020 it was canceled. They tried to schedule it for September and canceled that. So, but it's a great, like, if you were getting into that business, that's the best show to go to because there's, you know, 10 different flour companies, including Italian flour. There's 10 different tomato companies. There's every pepperoni company.
Stanislaus has that big booth in the middle where they're serving wine and people are sitting down.
You've been.
Yeah. Oh, I went last year. I wish that we had connected before last year. We could have sat and had a glass of wine at the Stanislaus booth.
Yeah. So
it's a great show. It's fantastic.
We've represented them since 1990. Really, our business was based around them, and they're just privately held Italian family. You know, Dino Cortopassi drove a school bus in Stockton, and when he went to community college, and you know, now he's, you know, the number one brand nationally. He started out renting some land to grow tomatoes, and now, you know, I think it's kind of public, but he does about 25 million cases of tomatoes, and he's the brand across the country.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, he's definitely a success story.
Absolutely. This podcast is not sponsored by Stanislaus, by the way.
Yeah. Trade shows are, no, but he is in food service, and with even all the distributor community, they know Stanislaus really well because he's, they've done a good job. But trade shows, like if I was a, you know, grocery retailer, I'd go to the specialty food show and in San Francisco, and there's one in New York, or I think it's in Milan, but to see specialty products. But there's the Boston Seafood Show. That's probably the best, because like a pizza show, there's 100 of me or 1,000 of me, you know, that are know that industry really well, because they've spent their career in it.
Yep.
So, and you can talk to, you know, at every booth, you can talk to somebody that's a, you know, owner or key person at that company.
And yeah, and people are just, you know, standing around waiting for people to ask them questions. I've learned so much at these trade shows, because it's the one time where you'll get distributors, manufacturers, you know, any sort of producer. You can even get farmers, you can get restaurant owners. So customers show up too. You have, you know, and brokers, if I didn't already say that, just standing around, they've already canceled all of their appointments. They've already, you know, canceled all their customer calls, and they are there to just talk with other people and network. And I couldn't agree more. The one thing I'd add to that is you will get small regional trade shows, usually put on, all the big distributors do it, you know, the Sysco's and US Foods and Performance Foods, and my company as well. We put on these trade shows, and we, you know, hand select and pull all of these different brokers, manufacturers, you know, other, and invite all of our customers. So it's, you can gain so much knowledge in a 24-hour or 48-hour period at these shows. I wasn't even thinking of going down that path to talk about resources, but you're spot on.
And it's free. You know, you get all those resources for free. You may have to fly to Vegas or, you know, that, but I mean, generally all those people you talk to that are experts, it'd take you a long time to identify and find those people. Like, you're not going to be able to walk into the Grandi cheese booth and, you know, and talk to one of the owners. You're not going to be able to do that, you know, the next week. You're not going to even be able to get a hold of them, but they're standing there and they want to talk to you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's super cool. All right, cool. Well, there's two pieces here that I wanted to jump into. We've been going on about an hour now, so thank you so much for your time here, going through all of these pieces. This has been really cool. For anybody
you can chop it up and edit, right?
Oh, for sure. I don't think there's anything we need to remove from this, though. I try to do these as unedited as possible. But if, you know, if we wanted to start over on any segment, we absolutely can. But no, this is perfect, man. You're a wealth of knowledge, and it shows. So we've really gone through everything. For the restaurant specific, distributor specific listeners here, we are going to switch gears a little bit. I'm going to talk about how some commodities are potentially related to others. And I found out the other day on the phone with Ross that we actually are both big fans of kind of the sound money, hard money economics. And he knows a little bit about gold markets, which is something that I'm absolutely fascinated by. I've been reading up and learning about things like Austrian economics and differences between that and Keynesian economics and all this stuff. So we're actually just going to touch on a couple of other things while I have him, so I can tap into that wealth of knowledge. But if you are not interested in other commodities and maybe getting an economics or potential investment-minded bent on this thing, then feel free to log off now. And I really appreciate you guys listening. So now that we've, probably lost about 70% of the listeners.
We get into the interesting stuff.
Yeah, we get to the interesting stuff. We can keep this brief, but I was fascinated to hear that you and I are aligned on a lot of our thinking, and that was pretty cool. So before jumping into gold and none of this, I have to say this is the first food service podcast I've had to say this, but none of this is investment advice. Obviously, we're not going to actually talk about investing, but just kind of how markets relate. But before we jump into gold, things like dairy and corn and other traded commodities, and this is just from my own knowledge, do you see any correlation in things like price with other markets outside of maybe other markets? You get to things that are scarce, like metals and like oil. Are those price correlated to food commodities?
So a good thing for, I think, for all of us to remember is that, if we're 300 million people and the world, I'll just use 6 because the math is good. So there's 20 times, there's for every person here, there's 20 people out there outside of our borders. So okay, right. International demand really does have huge impact. And then that's kind of tied to the strength of the dollar. So now the dollar's a little bit weaker right now. It might be because we're, spending $1 trillion a month more than we take in. But, so with the dollar a little weaker, the export market can pick up a little bit. So it does become a factor. Like the dairy, like you walk through one of the cheese plants and you think it's a dehydrated milk plant and you don't see much cheese because there's such a demand for if you walk through the center of a grocery store, pick up any box, you're going to see whey powder, non-fat milk powder, and mm-hmm. so many products because it's a relatively inexpensive ingredient. So big market for protein bars and snacks. I know in your distribution business is a big area, but it's big in Japan and Southeast Asia. So a lot of that product goes there into those markets. So there's the 20-1 outside our country, if we're priced right, they're going to buy it. There's that. Correlation, probably because of monetary policy, they're correlated, but as far as ingredients, they all have their own cost structure and I think impact, tomatoes, I'll use canned tomatoes as an example. I think there's 15 million metric tons packed, but maybe 4 or 5 of them go into canned tomatoes. The rest of them go into industrial paste that turn into barbecue sauce and all these. So it's a huge industry with not as much of it going into what you and I think of as canned tomatoes. So there's a lot of buffer really to keep price stability, in that commodity. But in California, like almonds, you look in your refrigerator, you probably got soy milk, oat milk, and almond milk. Or a lot, I look at my daughter's refrigerator and it's like, do you know what dairy is? Because she's got all these other milk alternatives in there. So in California, all of a sudden, almonds is huge, huge impact in the industry. So all this ground's going to almonds. So they're related, and it's, whatever the yield is to the farmer, because they don't necessarily care about a particular crop. It's what their yield is per crop on their return, per crop. So they fight for land, they fight for water, they all pay the same distribution costs, and then there's, changing consumer demand on the product. I don't know if that really answers your question exactly. It's a couple of things to consider, I guess.
Yeah, I'd say it does. It does answer it. I mean, they're not to some degree, they are correlated. I think you said the magic word there with to some degree with monetary policy, and then the demand coming from outside of the states on certain things. Anything perishable, obviously, the demand is going to be, you know, keep to North America or keep within the region that it was produced. If it's, you know, something like produce, like the stuff that we deal in. But yeah, when you start to get into monetary policy and what impact that has on markets, on price discovery, on society, you know, I always say, you know, so for anybody that doesn't know, monetary policy is just, you know, the way that the Federal Reserve, kind of changes the rules as we go. And it was put in place to increase or decrease the money supply and then increase or decrease interest rates to stimulate the economy, to suppress spending or increase spending. And I always like to say it's like, you know, for the average human being, it's like they're playing a game of baseball. And after every inning, the rules of the game change and the bat gets shorter and the ball, you know, turns into a volleyball. And that's what it's kind of like over a lifespan of dealing with or working with a currency or a pool of currencies that are being manipulated at the base level. So that's...
Yeah,
that's
who would have guessed, and you can't outguess or outlast the government, or at least the U.S. government, who would have guessed that 10-year treasuries were down to 0.5%. That's where they're at now, 0.5%. Historical mortgage rates were they use the 10-year treasury, and they're usually 1 to 1.25% over the 10-year treasury. That would put interest mortgage rates should really be at 1.5 to 1.75%. Well, you know what that would do to housing pricing if mortgage rates got down to there. But those mortgages are packaged and they're being sold based on, you know, a 2% yield. So mortgage brokers are making huge margins right now because they're writing mortgages at close to 3 mm-hmm. when the market really right now is 1.5 to 2. You know, so they're getting that premium on that. So it's just strange times because, you know, nobody knows how long that rate will stay there. And you cannot outguess the Fed.
No. It's interesting, man. I think a lot of the yield that people are finding in any industry is from fees right now, right? At least in the financial industry. So I like to say also, this is a, you know, and this might, if this is the first time you've heard this type of conversation, it might be a little, you know, freak you out a little bit, but this is the shortest monetary experiment in human history, what we're doing here with, you know, from, I would say 1971, when we unpegged the dollar from gold, when we were removed from the gold standard, to 2008. I mean, a lot happened in between then, but 2008, when we started this quantitative easing and expansion of the balance sheet. And, you know, we went from, I think, $800 billion to $7 trillion between 2006 and 2009, something like that. So we 10x'd the money supply. And, you know, now we've gone down the same path. So we're doing this, what a lot of people refer to as modern monetary theory or MMT. For the first time, this sustained, and history can tell us that it doesn't end well. Usually, doesn't end well for financial system and the underlying assets or the underlying currency, I should say, not assets. But we're you know, this time it's different, or we're doing something different because we have better computers and we're way smarter, right?
Right. Yeah, so I don't know if I can jump in. The ones that we do know that are facts that are going to affect the future is, you know, we used to get all upset about a $1 trillion deficit. Now we have $1 trillion months of deficit. And people, I know trillion's a big number. I don't know how many zeros are on it. And it doesn't really mean much to anybody, but I use the... a trillion is $3,000 per person. So when they're a $1 trillion deficit, that's 3,000 for you, David, and 3,000 for me that the government spent that they didn't have. So now that's a number I understand. Oh, I owe them $3,000 if we want to balance the books. So that's the deficit. The debt, you know, we'll probably end the year close to 30 trillion. So now 30 times 3,000, that's 90,000 for you and 90,000 for me that we owe to balance, to pay off the debt. So Some people could pay the 90, some people can't, but it's still, it's $90,000 that we owe. So, and then if we get into unfunded liability, we'll just do Medicare, because this, you know, everybody's going to rely on that at some point in their life if they're fortunate to live to that point. So over your lifetime, you pay in about $50,000, you and your employer, into the Medicare trust fund. There's no trust and there's no fund, but that's the taxes you pay that they spend. So 50,000 in, average spend out 200,000, shortfall $150,000 per person, times that by 330 million, just the people living today, you got about a $50 trillion unfunded liability. That's that's the big part of the iceberg that's gonna hit us. So massive amount of money. And then the people that can pay it, Romney got a lot of heat for saying only half the population pays federal taxes, but it was a fact. It was a fact. So if you take that deficit or the debt, $30 trillion, 90,000 for you and me, only half the people work. So that's really 180,000. The people that pay, that work, only half pay taxes. Now you got 360,000. Some people can pay the 360, but some can't. A lot can't. So now what do we do with that 360,000 or the $30 trillion? There's two ways to pay that thing off, is to raise taxes or depreciate it. And the way you depreciate that thing is you inflate. Because if all of a sudden your salary's double, your house is doubled, everything's doubled, the debt is still 30. Well, it's really half. So the easy way out is to inflate or devalue the dollar.
So, Ross, what does that do to, say I have $100 that I've had in my bank account for 10 years and we add, you know, $300 to the money supply, which is monetary inflation or just dollar inflation by adding, increasing the supply. What does that do to my purchasing power? Will I be able to buy the same stuff with my $100?
Yeah. Plus, probably the monthly fee, and it's all gone anyway because of service fees at the bank. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, if there's any recommendation or thought process that we should go through is, you know, hard assets are just, unless you think, if the government decides to tax, that'll reduce consumption and prices of assets would fall because there'd be less demand for them. So unless you believe the government is going to radically increase taxes and not just spend it on new programs, but pay off debt. Unless you think that and you subscribe to the idea of the easier route is just to inflate the debt away, hard assets are where to be and not in cash. Just, you know, not. So I listened to one of your other podcasts and I said, you know, it's good to have cash. And that's partially true. But, you know, for me, I kind of think it's good to have access to cash. So like most people, you know, you can really quickly have a credit card with $30,000 worth of credit limit. Great to pay it off monthly and have no, you know, nothing on that card. But then at least you have, which is another part of the money supply, access to that cash if you needed it. So I kind of view it that way. I'd rather have real estate equity in that real estate and not necessarily as much cash sitting there, because I think my cash is going to be like your $100 in 10 years from now. You can't get as much with it.
Sure. You know, so you are spot on. And that's funny that you caught that. That's maybe the only time in this that I've mentioned you should have cash. And it's to listeners of this podcast, they don't take too deep of a dive into the, Austrian economic stuff that I like to think about and talk about, the sound money stuff. But what people don't realize and what I missed out on, cause I didn't get too deep in it, is that cash should be, so dollars, if you have a balance, should be looked at as a relatively short-term investment because it is depreciating. Your purchasing power is going down, over even the midterm, especially over the long term. So having, that's a better way to put it, having access to cash. I think my whole point is not just to be so overextended and not have any sort of assets. So maybe not access to cash, but access to something that's physical, something that's scarce, something that you can trade in for US dollar liquidity if you get into a situation where you have to close the doors of your restaurant for 4 weeks, or you run into a situation you don't want to have to close the doors for good because you are so debt heavy and you don't have any assets or any buying power.
Yeah, no, and I agree. I was kind of making a joke or pun at your hold cash, but yeah. Probably the over and within your idea is it's really about living below your income, yeah. You know, so that you have surplus and so that surplus can carry you at a time when your income's impacted. Absolutely. You know, people that had, you know, because I know restaurateurs, when they had, you know, no surplus, I felt bad for them because they're, you know, how are they going to pay for groceries tomorrow? Or lower income people, you feel for them. Whereas if you had, you know, whether you have credit card access to, you know, debt there or assets that you convert or cash, you know, it takes away the stress, a lot of that stress. So to live below your means is probably the most powerful thing, you know, to do. And keep the stress level down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we are all, I think I mentioned the term default Keynesian when we talked the other day. You know, we are all programmed from a young age, anybody alive today, at least who lives in America or in the Western world, to think that the economy is strong only when people are consuming, right? And that saving is bad, that deflation will destroy the economy. You know, there's all of these things. It's a little backwards to how human beings have worked with each other in just basic trade. I mean, you go down to the fundamentals of economics and of price discovery and competition. And we are on this path, have been for about, you know, 100 years or so. I guess, you know, something happened in 1913 that kind of changed the way that we view money in the States and globally. And if anybody doesn't know, that's when the Federal Reserve was created. There's a whole story, The Creature from Jekyll Island, if anybody wants to read about the origins of the Federal Reserve. It's an interesting read. But, you know, we don't look at savings as a good thing. We look at consumption and spending as the barometer for the health of the economy. And I think that's really backwards to how, not even how things could be or should be, but that's backwards to how people who are very wealthy and very successful view money. So you can kind of tell the financial literacy of somebody by how they view what money is. You know, what is money? Is it purchasing power or is it the amount of dollars that you have? So there's a lot there that I think is just ingrained into us as human beings in the year 2020 and for the past, you know, 50 years especially. That if when you get paid, you get paid, you take out a little bit of debt, you overextend yourself and you spend it all. You know, it's like when you get a bonus and people ask, what are you going to spend it on? Like, oh, I'm not spending this.
Yeah. You know, another kind of side note I'd like to remind people of is, you know, so our 30 trillion or 20 trillion, whatever number you want to take debt. Mm-hmm. If interest rates go up on that debt, 1%, that's $300 billion in interest for that 1 year. If they went up 2%, that'd be $600 billion in interest, added new interest. That's the Defense Department budget. So it's massive. If interest rates, that's why I think the Fed will do what they can to hold that down and not have to pay more interest on that debt. But that's a massive, it's not just sitting there as debt. It's actually, we pay on that. We pay to service that debt. And, you know, if interest rates go up, we're in trouble.
Absolutely. And that's the big struggle that we're in right now, right? Is trying to keep interest rates low. I mean, what, from your perspective, everybody has a different opinion on this short term, you know, what are we going to see with, you know, inflation versus deflation, or what are we going to see? But long term, is there a way to actually tackle the debt? Is there a way to actually handle this? Or
two choices. It's the tax or deflate. You know, that's
taxing our great grandchildren.
Right.
If we do even a 90% tax.
Yeah, no. Well, inflate is the way to make that disappear. It just, you know.
Yeah.
first house I bought, I think I paid $60,000 for it, you know. You know, now you pay that for a good car, you know. So, you know, it's not that many years ago either. So you can just count on, you know, the easier way out of this is to let it inflate, you know, devalue the dollar slowly under control. Nobody likes, you know, it's what's disruptive is anything that's immediate and fast. But if you just do it gradually, you know, people can adjust to it. You know, you don't want Argentina, Venezuela inflation rates, but you know, if you got inflation to run at, you know, 6%, and in 12 years, you know, everything had doubled in price, the debt's in half. You know, probably our challenge is to get to a balanced budget and then chip away at, you know, some debt's fine. You know, you can service, you know, some debt. But it'd be nice to be in a position to be able to handle, we're in Washington State, so, and probably every state's in this spot, you're in trouble. You know, they, you know, their tax revenue is not there, and they don't print, they can't print money. So they, you know, even though they don't like the Trump administration, they all have their hand out asking for a bailout to handle, you know, their budget, because they're short. You know, every single state's short. Washington State, you know, gets about a third of their income from property taxes. Well, that's kind of stable. Get a third of theirs from sales tax. Well, that's not good. And then, you know, the other third is, you know, B&O and some of their fees, which is, you know, a little more stable, but they're short, you know, and, you know, it's, you know, it's tough, you know. So if you have that rainy day fund, well, we're wiping that one out in Washington. It's, you know, that's wiped out. And Seattle doesn't have it. And Seattle's got, you know, that's got all its problems. So, you know, they're, you know, at every level, the jurisdictions are in trouble because they got a cost structure up. You know, probably your idea of having cash is important probably applies more to the public sector. And if they would live like that, where they could handle, you know, the rainy day and absorb some downturns, because they can't, it's not there.
Yeah. Yeah, you're spot on. One thing that you kind of went past there without touching on in the cost of your house, right? So you're seeing the cost of homes in cyclical or relatively flat areas in America, at least. Well, really, we're seeing it globally increasing. The amount that incomes are increasing over the years are not increasing at the same rate. So if we're looking at something like, you know, asset prices and CPI inflation, all the stuff increase, there should be a equal increase to whether or not you prescribe to the minimum wage. You should see a equal increase in wages and an income going up at the same level. But we're not really seeing that, are we?
No, but you can. There's one other factor, and that is interest rates. So if you cut interest rates in half, you can double the house price. You know, and then there's, you know, demand and, you know, we're in a market that's strong. This morning's paper had Whatcom County house prices up 12%. I think Kitsap, you know, Seattle's up 8% year over year. So huge, but there's no inflation, right? Right? There's no inflation nationally, but house prices went up 8%. How's that? You know, so that, you know, we are seeing it, and it's maybe excluded from the CPI, or they're, you know, doing some math so it, you know, it prints well. But, you know, you and I know there's food inflation going on right now. There's housing inflation. Well, and there's healthcare inflation. So if you look at your budget, you think, well, what else do I spend money on? You know, okay, so my TV got better and cheaper, but that's not really my monthly budget.
Yeah, and I think we almost touched on this. When you look at something like CPI inflation and asset inflation is two separate things. The CPI numbers that we look at now are different from how we used to measure consumer price index. For anybody who doesn't know that term, the CPI is the consumer price index. It's how you see, you know, the price of goods and services across a industry. And the CPI inflation target is usually 2%. That's the target to try and get to 2% annually. The way that we measure inflation has changed substantially. And what we do now compared to what we did maybe in the 70s and 80s is we can even take an iPhone and say, all right, well, this is 10% better So, you know, we're going to add that as a deflationary tool or deflationary force on the inflation numbers. So a lot of these things that are inflationary and deflationary are pressed together, and a lot of the components are have been removed and taken out so that it's not necessarily what is the real cost of all these goods and let's put these together and get a number. It's our target's 2%. Now, how do we manipulate these numbers to get to 2%? And that's just how it is right now. But a lot of people, just this short portion of this call, the majority of people do not ever think about this stuff, and they just take the percentages and the numbers and the jobs numbers and all this stuff at face value and say, okay, we hit the number, that's good. And nobody really asks, you know, how did they get to the number? And has that changed? Has the way that they've gotten to these numbers changed over the years, or has it stayed the same?
Yeah. And yeah, what's it mean? So, hey, yeah. I could talk to you all day. I had two things that you can edit out if you want, but I wanted to run by. So, it's an election year and just a lot of talk. And I think the polarization and a lot of it comes down to, people talking about whether we want capitalism, socialism, or communism. And I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. Our country wasn't really an experiment, but we started out as tried to do a collective, and it didn't work because everybody was farming together in a co-op. And so there's no motivation to work hard and excel because you just got the same amount as the person next to you. So it was, people were starving to death. They, you know, fortunately the Indians actually helped them and provided some food. So then they started to separate plots and you could till your own area. And then people worked harder and that community succeeded. Now it's a really simplistic view of capitalism, but that's kind of what capitalism is. So it's individualism where you rely on yourself to provide for yourself. So it's capitalism, just clean capitalism. So socialism is you start to do a collective, some parts of it are collective. And then communism that gets a totally a bad rap, and I'm not supporting that, but if people want to really understand it, it's one sentence really, or two. It's from each according to their ability and to each according to their need. Well, if you think about it, that's the way family works with kids, you know. They contribute what they can, and your job is to raise them up. And a family works really like communism. It's central planning. But that hasn't worked in society, you know, throughout, you know, you can just list all the ones that it hasn't worked at, because what it does is take away motivation from people. So historically, capitalism has worked better than communism. But we're not polarized like that, because people say, oh, I'm anti-socialism. But what's our education system? It's socialized. What's our healthcare system? It's mostly socialized. So if you're 65 or low income, you're on Medicaid or Medicare. And if you work for, 40% of the people work for the public sector. So I would argue that that's a socialized medicine if you work for, you know, government entity. So we're talking about like a good 50-60% of the population is already on socialized medicine. So people are anti-socialized medicine. We're there already. Mm-hmm. So many of our segments, public safety, so fire and police, you don't pay for your own safety systems. I mean, it may come to that in Seattle, but you don't. So those are all, we have a substantially socialized country. Our tax, you know, burden or tax rate is approaching 50% when you add in all the, you know, state, local, federal. So 50% of what we spend on is socialized items that the government provides for us. So anybody that's completely anti-socialism is anti what we got going right now. So we have a hybrid system right now. We have some capitalism and some socialism. So I just kind of like to cover that. And then with what's going on nationally, what made our country great and what makes pretty much every country work is property rights and rule of law. If you lose those, you have anarchy. And we've seen that elsewhere too. So that's kind of my political statement. And then my one last thing is for people to think about, and I'm not pro one way or the other on this, but when they wrote the US Constitution, they didn't write in there protection for me to keep chickens in my yard. You know, it's not in there, but everybody had them, right? So it's not protected by the Constitution because everybody had them. You didn't need to address it in the Constitution because everybody had them. Well, now we changed the laws and I can't have chickens in my yard. Okay, so I'm not really talking about chickens though. But if you look at the Second Amendment, you should read the Second Amendment. I don't think, if you read that, everybody had a gun. Why would you need to protect a gun? You have a gun and a chicken. Everybody had guns. You don't need to protect that in the Constitution. You do need to protect, though, that there's the right to have a militia. So if you read that, my impression of that was that it was protecting the right to have an organized militia at the state level, mm-hmm. not individual gun rights. I'm not saying you should take away gun rights, but it doesn't make sense to me that you would protect something like a chicken in the Constitution. Everybody had it. That's my thought.
I love it. I love it. Absolutely. You know, there was something else written into the earliest documents of the founding of this great country. And that was, we would never use money outside of gold and silver. We had just escaped that. We had just gotten away from Great Britain and, you know, the flimsy fiat money and taxation without representation. And everything that we've been talking about here, Ross, is a form of taxation. You know, inflation is a form of taxation at the highest level. So it's, you know, we're not sitting around taking a vote on this stuff saying, hey, what should we do? It's, you know, 10 or 12 people sitting around in a room making those choices that affects our
brought it down another I think interesting point. So I was at when the Seattle mayor got elected, she had community meetings, and I went to one and I asked this question, and I didn't really expect a good response, but it said, the country was founded because, or was we separated from England primarily because of taxation without representation. I said, Seattle kind of has the opposite problem right now. And what do you think about this? We have representation without taxation. So we have all kinds of people that can dominate the vote and create change, and they're not taxpayers. So our problem today is representation without taxation.
That's so funny.
My thought.
I love it, man. That's great. That's a great way to end this. That's a perfect way to end it. I really appreciate you taking the time. We just went. Yeah. I know you've got another meeting coming up soon. So yeah. I'm going to do a very, very light edit of this.
No problem at all. Nobody had listened to the whole thing, but I had a great time talking to you.
Likewise, man. All right. Well, have a great rest of your day. Have an awesome weekend. To everybody else listening, it's Friday. Get outside. Go have some fun. And Ross, thanks again, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care. See you.
Yep. Bye.